Dr. David Elkind is critical of a recent phenomenon in child rearing, the desire to raise super kids, kids who can swim, read, work computers, play the violin, and recognize a Picasso before they've even entered kindergarten. To Dr. Elkind, this preschool pressure is miseducation. Elkind is a professor of child study at Tufts University, where he is the senior resident scholar. He's also the president of the National Association for the Education of Young Children. His latest book is titled Miseducation, Children at Risk. I spoke to him from station WBUR in Boston. He told me what he means by miseducation.
Well, I guess I ought to define miseducation first. What I mean is teaching children the wrong things and putting them at risk for no purpose. A good example is swimming for infants of 3 months. We know that infants are particularly subject to middle ear infection and potentially permanent hearing loss. They're subject to autoasphyxiation from swallowing water, and they're also subject to diarrhea if those infants are not toilet trained and are not properly packaged. So there are a lot of risks. There's no proven benefit. There's no evidence that children retain the skills they learn. They have to relearn at a later age. So here's a clear evidence of children being engaged in an activity which puts them at risk, has no proven benefit, and that's what I mean really by miseducation. The same was with showing infants flashcards at 3 months.
What's the risk there? They're not going to get diarrhea from it.
Pardon me? No, you're not going to get diarrhea from it. That's true. Maybe mental diet. But there's no proven value to it, and it does perhaps for some parents who get too involved in it, it can put the relationship between the infant and the child and the mother or father at risk because they've got too caught up in right answers, wrong answers, that the wrong attitude to have towards an infant. We shouldn't be expecting an infant to be getting something right or wrong. And so it can, and that's a period when it's very important for children to learn a sense of trust in their parents, the sense that these parents are going to be there for them and take care of them regardless. And so it puts, you know, the relationship at risk. Now, some parents may, you know, may not get that kind of involved, but some parents may. So why do it? Why risk that kind of engagement when it has no proven value?
You make the point that parents used to be concerned about having normal kids, and now they want super kids, and they want to make normal kids into exceptional kids. What do you think is responsible for that change?
Well, I think there's a new parent psychology today. I think we were in the past, there's always been a sort of switch from nature to nurture, from the environment to heredity and so on. And I think we had a kind of nature attitude, maturation, readiness. We thought that, you know, we just let children grow and allow them to grow. And then that changed really in the 60s, and we became much more concerned with nurture. Almost anything you could do, you know, you could change children in any way and make them almost anything. You know, in the 60s, we heard that you could teach any child anything at any time. The children were little sponges, and they just sopped up information. They had half of their abilities at age 4, so they had to get all this stuff. So there was a whole new psychology, and I think what's happened is that parents today believe that they have a great deal more responsibility for how their children turn out, and that makes them much more anxious and much more guilty. Am I doing the right thing? I mean, parents have always felt that, but when they feel that they have so much input, and that anxiety and guilt, I think, makes them particularly vulnerable now to the entrepreneurs who are selling all these programs. And unless you use my program, your child isn't going to become or realize his potential, isn't going to become a little Leonardo or something. And so I think that there's the changed parental psychology, parents having fewer children, the parents having them longer at older ages, having a greater sense of somehow their responsibility of, you know, that unless they do the right thing, their children aren't going to turn out right and it's going to be their fault. I think that parents in the past had a greater sense of the maturational thing and that their input wasn't going to make that much difference. It was important. And so I think that's what's different, and I think it's the anxiety and the guilt that many parents feel today which makes them so vulnerable to the swimming classes and the flashcards and the gymberees and all of those other things which may, you know, they're on a continuum from least, you know, gymberee, maybe do very little harm to children and to something like swimming, which can, have very lethal consequences. So
when you say anxiety and guilt that parents are feeling, you mean their anxiety and guilt about working and not being home with the children?
No, that too, but I think partly that and partly about their sense of responsibility for the child, that they feel that how that child turns out is going to be largely their responsibility. Often they've carved their own careers, they've been successful, they feel that they've had worked out their own marriages, they feel that they've been a superwoman or superman, and now they should have a super child. And so they feel there's a greater sense of being in charge of their own lives and being in charge of their children. And suddenly, as one mother told me recently, who's an executive, that suddenly here was this child that she really felt she could handle, and all of a sudden it just didn't work the way she thought it was going to work. And he keeps calling her Dada instead of Mama, and doing things that the infant isn't just as manageable as other things might have been in her life. And so it's that sort of thing at the one hand, feeling that you have more charge and you have more control, and then discovering that you don't, and also this great sense of your ability to input into that. And then, as you say, then there's the added guilt and that feeling that way, and then feeling that you have to work and not put in all of the time and energy that you need means that often parents will go overboard to compensate for that and rationalize often that a child needs this high-pressure program to alleviate their own guilt, rather than because they really are convinced that it's in the best interest of the child. So there are a lot of different dynamics going on, but the end result is that we miseducate children, we engage them in activities which put them at risk, have no proven value.
My guest is Dr. David Elkind. He's a professor at Tufts University and the author of several books on child development. His new book is called Miseducation: Preschoolers at Risk. You know, you talk about the different kinds of motivations that different types of parents have for miseducating their children. And I'd like to go through with you some of the categories that you've suggested that different parents fall into. I think this is actually very instructive. You've labeled one group of parents gourmet parents. Would you describe what the motivation there is?
Yeah. Gourmet parents are often parents who have been successful in their own lives, and they want to share that success with their children, which is perfectly appropriate, except they often do it at too early an age, so that children at 3 may be taken to Europe, go to fancy restaurants, be taken to ski slopes and so on. And that's fine to share that kind of experience and wealth with children, but once they're old enough to fully appreciate and take credit and enjoy it. But at an early age, it can just have the opposite effect. It can make children a little bit arrogant, a little bit superior to other children and to the teachers and so on. And so it may have negative consequences. It's not that it's bad in and of itself. It's bad because it's introduced to children too early before they really can appreciate and benefit from it.
Then you introduce a category which you call gold medal parents.
Gold medal parents are those who believe that the royal road to success in life is achievement in sports, and they go to great lengths of both expense and time and money to train their child in a particular sport, such as skating and ice skate, tennis, swimming. And there's nothing wrong with that, except that parents are beginning to start with children at younger and younger ages, even before the age of 5, so that children are 3 and so on. I don't think one can really assess whether a child at that age has talent. Children at that age are still vulnerable. The bones aren't fully calcified. The muscles haven't attained full volume. Put the child at risk for physical ailments. There's a whole specialty of pediatrics, not pediatric sports medicine, for children who have injuries through sports. And so, and particularly with the preschool level, there are real dangers. There's dangers of putting a child at that age in competition. Again, some children may not be harmed and may survive it very well, and some families may handle it very well. Others don't, and again, because there's no proven benefit that starting a child that early has any long-lasting value, as opposed to starting the child later when he or she is more mature physically and emotionally and sociologically, then why do it? And it's just this sort of new psychology that somehow earlier is better, and that if you start a child earlier, the child will end faster and better. And again, that's simply not true.
Well, you raise the point, well, why do it? And you say that a lot of the parents who fit into this category hold middle management jobs, and they want the sense of vicarious excitement through their children.
That's true. I think that some of these parents that I see anyway, the are sort of a dead end in their career. They really don't see themselves going anywhere, and their jobs are dull. And then the child's competition provides excitement, challenge in their own lives, and so they live in a way vicariously through the children.
There's a group that I found especially interesting here. You describe this group as encounter group parents. Would you describe that?
Encounter group parents are sort of a carryover from the 60s. They're parents who are very much into psychotherapy, into the various kinds of programs, and into the letting things, expressing things, getting things out in the open, talking, relating, connecting, all of those. And that can be a very healthy orientation. Again, there's nothing wrong with any of these styles, except it's inappropriate for children in early age, and because some of these parents want to, you know, walk around nude for little children. If the whole society does that, it may be okay, but we don't do that in our society, and it can be embarrassing for that child. And there are other things. So, you know, again, it's wanting children to, the motivation in itself is nothing wrong with wanting children to be open psychologically and know what their feelings are and to talk and express themselves. But 3-year-olds are not in a position to really know what their feelings are, to know how to deal with nudity, or some parents even, you know, have the children watch them engage in sexual activity. Little ones really can't deal with that very well. And so it would be better, if you really believe in those things, to postpone it until the time when children are sufficiently old enough so they can talk about it anyway and deal with the feelings in a reasonable way. But children really can't, little ones really can't talk about their feelings. And so they may be frightened or they may be excited without any way of dealing with that.
Yeah, this is a kind of super kid that I hadn't thought of myself in these terms. But you say that some parents want their kids to be psychological super kids and to be so open and honest and, you know, understanding of emotions. You say that these are the parents, too, who think that it's never too young to tell their children about the dangers of nuclear war. Now, I think this is the type of thing that really parents don't know what to do about. I mean, do you think that there is a time when you do not want to tell your children about it, when it's not going to help them to be more understanding about the world and caring about each other?
That's right.
Just forget telling them about it.
It may be just frightening. For example, people want to teach young children about AIDS. Well, what are young children going to do about AIDS? Are they going to stop having sex? I mean, you know, all you do, they know that there's something frightening out there. They can't do anything about it. And so I learned long ago as a therapist that you try never to take anything away from a patient without giving them something in return. When you tell a young child about a threatening thing like AIDS or something, the child may be frightened by that, or nuclear war, but what is the child going to do? There's nothing the child can do to take any action. If you're an adult, you can, you know, you can take precautions. If you're an adult, you can march against nuclear war, you can write letters, you can take some action. But if you're a little child, what can you do? All you can do is be frightened. And so when we expose children to those things, we should make very sure that there's something that children can do about it, that we don't just tell them there's something frightening out there, but we give them some way of handling the anxieties that we create. And I think that hasn't happened. We want to share our anxieties with the child, but we don't share, you know, the capacity to deal something with those anxieties. So I think the problem with that is that many parents feel this kind of need to share their anxiety with the child. The child should be aware, but they don't follow through in providing that child with some, you know, way, rational way, a meaningful way to deal with the anxiety. And if they can't do that, then the child shouldn't be exposed to it in the first place.
Another example that falls into the category that you describe is encounter group parents. You say that a lot of parents, in wanting their children to really understand the ways of the world, will have their 4-year-old present at the mother's birth of a new child. Do you think it's bad for a young child to witness childbirth? I think more and more parents are doing that as a way to make the new baby more real, you know, for the sibling.
Well, here again is a good example of miseducation. There's absolutely no evidence, research evidence. There's no tradition, social or cultural, to back that up. It almost ends up being a fad. We know that it's a frightening experience for a 4-year-old. One mother, as I tried to say in the book, said, you know, it's going to bring us closer together in the family. There's absolutely no evidence for that a child witnessing that, bringing it closer together than as a family. The, you know, it's a kind of a faddish thing, which for a four-year-old, it's the mother's in pain, there's blood, the child doesn't understand that, all of the what's going on. It can be a very frightening experience. Later on, the child can understand the whole process of birth and so on, but not at that age. So you end up, again, frightening the child without the child really being, I mean, children don't really understand the whole biological process. They don't understand life and death, basically, because they don't understand biology. And that doesn't really happen until 9 or 10. So the whole functioning can just be a very, very frightening experience without much cognitive understanding of what's going on, and without any research or any data or any social or cultural or religious tradition to back it up. So I have to believe it's a fad, and yet, as you say, many, many parents are doing it under this sort of pressure that, you know, that there's some kind of magic to this experience, which is somehow going to benefit the child. And what's really sort of, you know, amazing to me, these are intelligent, well-meaning parents who get caught up in such fads. And although they would check very carefully before they gave their child a vitamin, they looked at the ingredients of all the foods, the food additives and so on, and yet they do these things. It reminds me of people who have worked so hard to put up their life savings. They work, you know, and all of a sudden they'll give the whole savings to some person they've just met who's going to invest it for them. It's this kind of disparity between that is so striking that in some ways we are very, very cautious, in other ways we just throw caution to the winds.
I want to talk with you more about different manifestations of the super kid phenomenon, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Dr. David Elkind. He's a professor at Tufts University and the author of several books on child development. His new book is titled Miseducation, Preschoolers at Risk. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Dr. David Elkind, is the president of the National Association for the Education of Young Children. You know, I'm thinking for parents who don't really want to worry about their children reading before kindergarten or learning, you know, math or foreign languages. There's still so much pressure from the society. For instance, if everybody else on your block is teaching their kids this stuff early, then you do run the risk of your children feeling kind of behind and out of it when they go to school. What would you suggest to parents who feel that at this point, since so many parents are sending their children to these early programs, that you have to do it just to keep up?
Well, I know that many parents feel that way, and all I can do is reassure them that if they don't, the child will not be left out. There have always been children who are different and who don't do things that everybody else in the neighborhood does. Certain children who don't belong to the same religion as other children don't do it, and parents, if they feel strongly about that, they say, well, this is not what my child does. And so I think you have to feel exactly the same way about these high-pressure things. I've seen many children, for example, whose parents did not allow them to watch television. Their friends watch television and so on. And it was hard, but I see them now at the college level, and they're doing very well. They're good readers. They're interested. They're not deficient in friends or anything else. I think it's just very hard, or harder today, to be a parent in some ways than it has been in the past, because there are all these pressures. And what we have to recognize is that they may do children more harm than good, and that if you really believe strongly in not having this kind of over-academic pressure at an early age, that, enroll your child in a good child-centered nursery school or program. And I think that the other thing is to find parents who share the same values and the same orientation as you do, so that you have a support group of parents who feel the same way. And I think that it's like so many other things. If you really feel strongly about it, I think one has to, bite the bullet and really resist some of the social pressures. Easy for me to say. I know that.
Your kids are grown. I think a lot of parents will want to know, what are the effects of these early education programs? Will they help someone? Will they help a child learn when they get to school? Will the advancement really pay off? What is the evidence on that? Are there any studies about the actual academic values of this early education?
Well, We're just beginning to get some. Some of the studies which suggest that the early academic programs, for example, the ones that have been followed up, but there's one study, a recent study, which is one of the best ones that we have, is that at 15, the children who were in the academic programs were more likely to be involved in delinquent activity than children who were in the less academic programs, the more child-centered programs. I think the most powerful data comes from schools. One of the most consistent findings we have in the public school system is the children who are the youngest in the kindergarten class, and that's true whether they're four and the oldest are five, or the youngest are five and the oldest are six, do more poorly both short and long term than children who are the oldest. That is, these children are more likely to drop out of school, more likely to have poor grades than our children who are the oldest. Now, that has nothing to do with intelligence. It has to do with the fact that the curriculum is always geared to the oldest children, which means that if you have a curriculum which is too hard for, that is, you're teaching reading at the kindergarten to first grade for the, you know, before these children are ready, that they're going to have learning problems. So that what you see here is the direct effect of a curriculum which is not appropriate for that age group. And I think you can extend that backwards if you're pushing these kids. If you have that effect already at kindergarten, you're certainly going to have it at an earlier age as well. That if these children are exposed to things which they can't learn, the feeling of failure and so on, although it's not the same in school as in school, because they may, not the social kind of thing, but if these children are in a, I mean, if parents are doing it at home, but if they're learning it in a school situation and they fail at an early age, the possibilities are just the same as they will be later, that those children are going to have more difficulty later than earlier. All the evidence suggests that earlier is not better as far as education is concerned. Of course, you don't wait forever, but what we do is age appropriate. We give the kind of children the kind of learning experiences and the kind of instruction that is most appropriate for that age level. The problem with these early instructional programs is that they're inappropriate to what we know about how children learn.
Dr. Eckin, let me ask you a couple of quick things before we run out of time. You are, in your practice, I believe, in your private practice, seeing a lot of young children who have symptoms of stress. Do you associate that with this super kids orientation?
Oh, yes. And I think that pediatricians are seeing that around the country. We see eating disorders, sleep disorders, belly aches and headaches are what we're seeing. I have a pediatrician friend who's treating a four-year-old for a peptic ulcer. Stress is an extraordinary demand for adaptation. When we expect children to do things which they're not prepared to do, when we expect them to deal with and learn things which are too difficult for them to learn, that's an enormous stress. And so I think miseducation does stress children, and we're seeing the impact of this on obviously, there are many other stresses in children's lives, but when we couple those with academic pressures far beyond what the child can cope with, then we maximize that stress. And so I think you're very right. We are seeing more stress in young children today than in the past.
You point out that a lot of parents assume that their children really like the ballet lessons that they're being sent to at 3 years old, or really like learning how to read when they're two because they seem to enjoy it. But you say that it's sometimes hard to tell whether they're enjoying the pleasure it's bringing the parents, whether they're actually enjoying the lessons themselves. How would you recommend that parents evaluate whether their children are actually enjoying and appreciating, benefiting from the extracurricular type things that the parents are trying to give them at a very early age?
Well, if the child does it without their being present, if they continue to take Suzuki or take ballet if the parents aren't there, then it's clear that the child does it, when often the parents are there and urging the child on. It's very difficult once the child's begun, because the child knows that that's something the parent wants them to do, and therefore children will, often do it to please the parents, rather than because it's something that they themselves want to do. Whereas the studies of gifted and talented people who really been successful in life suggest that those parents watch the child. And it seems to me very few children are going to want to do ballet by themselves at three. They may want to tap on the piano, they may want to tap. So it's hard for me to believe that comes from the child. And then what you've done is because you've imposed your priorities, which may sometimes work, on the child, rather than giving the child a sense to say what their vein is, where they want to go, the sort of things that make the most sense for them. And I think the evidence suggests that the best way to do it is for young children is to observe them and see where their interests lie, where their talents are, rather than trying to decide for them what we would like them to do.
Briefly, what would you suggest that parents look for in a nursery school or a daycare center?
Well, certainly would look for a teacher or teachers who have some training in early childhood development. Look for a program which is rich in materials such as blocks, which is organized into interest areas rather than desks, which has a place for language with books and places for children to read, cushions, perhaps a rocking chair, a good science and math area but a lot of manipulative things for children to count and to measure, to water to, and sand to explore with, magnifying glasses, things like that. Children really need to manipulate the world. They learn a great deal, but they need to have very concrete things to learn with. A dramatic art area, a dramatic play area, with a lot of abandoned adult clothing, like hat and shirts and shoes, that children can play with, tables for just doing a variety of different kinds of things, like making collages or making Easter baskets, all the different kinds of things that children do.
Sounds more like the conventional nursery school.
Yeah, conventional nursery school, but with using the materials, I think that we've progressed a lot. It may look the same, but what teachers do with those materials are very different, because they're exploring, they're expanding, they're helping those children learn a great deal more with a lot of the materials that are there. So it looks like, for example, children are just making soup, but they're learning a lot of things about it. They're learning to weigh and measure. They're learning the chemistry about what happens when you heat things. They're learning language. So I think teachers are more aware now of the kind of learning events that are happening in those activities and are helping children to realize to the full the knowledge that can be acquired in those activities.
Well, David Elkin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thank you for being with
thank
us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dr. David Elkin. He's a professor of child study at Tufts University and the president of the National Association for the Education of Young Children. He's the author of several books on child development. His new book is titled Miseducation, Preschoolers at Risk. It's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.